I'm sure did not go to a social worker school, but with the knowledge that you had working at the JEA, Jewish Educational Alliance, and the Washington Center, that he qualified because he had a brilliant mind. He really had a brilliant mind, and he had a mouth. He never needed any loudspeaker because he was a thin man, but you could hear him all over. When he opened up his mouth, you had to perk up your ears and listen because he said something. And Mr. Bluestone, you know, graduated as a dentist. Yeah, he honestly is a doctor. See, now the story he told me this. Now, I don't know whether this is publication. I think if you're going to write this, you should check it out with his wife first. That his father was a doctor. His brothers were doctors. And his sisters married doctors, except one sister married a... was an artist, and she was married to a doctor. And the sister in Denver, who's still alive, was also married to a doctor. And when the twins were born, he was part of a twin. Yes. And the father said, well, we have enough doctors in the family. You two are going to study dentistry. And so they both became dentists. Now, his brother Aaron practiced dentistry in New York. And with the Depression along, and he also worked. He went to school in Denver. And he also worked in the... well, I don't know whether they call them centers or settlement houses or something in New York. Mrs. Bluestone could tell you more about that. And I think that's where he met Mrs. Bluestone, while he worked at these at a center or whatever they called them. It was Mr. Bluestone that insisted that we change the YM and YWHA to the center because he said it was a hub for the Jewish community. And a lot of us were very angry because we worked very hard to put that Y where it was. And so when Mr. Bluestone decided that he was going to go to social worker school and get his master's, and he did. And that's when he really went into the social worker's field. And now I'm not sure, but I think either Staten Island or Buffalo was his first job, but he worked at both those places. Now, Staten Island could have been the first place, or Buffalo was the first place. And then he came down to be interviewed with other candidates when Mr. Soller was ready to leave. And now Mr. Soller went to Baltimore, where he had a marvelous position offered to him in San Francisco, but they didn't want to move away from these because of their folks, and Mrs. Soller especially because of her folks. And by that time, they had their two children, and they had a lot of heartache before they had their two children because they lost two before that. And he got the job, the JEA. And did I tell you that when he heard the war was over, that he came running for it? When he was offered this job in Baltimore, I asked him please not to go. I just had a feeling that the war had to be over, that if we, you know, could stand so much, how do the people over in Europe feel, you know? And we thought we just had to, because the war in Europe was already over, but we were still fighting. America was still fighting Japan. And I remember I went home from work, and he went down the steps, and he says, wish me luck. He was going for an interview in Baltimore. I says, you know, I won't wish you anything but the best. I wish you only the best. I says, but I don't really want you to take that job. I want you to wait. And he says, what assurance do I have? I says, nobody has any assurance, but how much more can we stand? I says, well, go ahead. And he left. Then he was already working. He lived up in Wilmington for 2 years before he moved down there, working in Baltimore. And I went home that day. I don't remember the exact date, but I came home for dinner, and I turned on the radio. And just before I sat down to eat, the radio went on, and President Roosevelt announced, the war is over. The war is over. The war is over. That's all was said. And I looked at my mother, and we started hugging and kissing each other. I could cry now. And the tears rolling down my face. I said, Mom, I got to go. And she didn't even answer me. Where am I going to go, you know? And I ran out of the house, and I ran from my house all the way down to the Jewish Center. And I ran up the steps, and just as I got to the top of the steps, the door opened, and in ran Is Solid. He probably heard it before I did on the radio in Baltimore, and he grabbed the first train out and came running back to the YMAJ too. And we both grabbed each other, and I said, "It's over. I asked you to wait. It's over." Oh, God. Well, everybody, with no different reaction than any place in the anywhere in the United States. I do remember that Mrs. Abelman, Mr. Abelman, he was head of the War Manpower Commission, Mr. Abelman was very friendly with them, and he always came around the Y, and they asked me if they could get a ticket, would I want to get down? The train was going to stop in Wilmington. They went down. And if they could get a pass for me, would I go with them down to when the train stopped at the railroad station? And I don't know whether I was in the center alone that I couldn't go, or whether they just couldn't get a pass for me. But the people went down, but everybody couldn't go up on the platform. You had to have a pass to get up there, and they were trying very hard to get me a pass to get up there. Oh, boy, really something. You know, you think back, you know, all these little things that were really outstanding, and you just don't know.
So how long was Mr. Lister, he lived here all his, you know, life after he came here? How long was he director at SIN?
Well, when Mr. Poussin came, it was in 46, was it, I think. Yeah, around 46, and they lived down at Ellesmere. And then they bought the house out on 34th Street, and they lived there. And he was losing his hearing. See, that was one of the main reasons why he was going to leave, too. Because he could stand in front of a room and he wasn't hearing. He had one operation after another. As a matter of fact, he was one of the first, I think, that went to New York and had his operation on his ear. That's another thing I think you ought to clear with Mrs. Bluestone, too. Dr. Lempert operated on him. And there were times I had to call while he was in the hospital. Things would occur and I would call into New York, you know. Or the incident when the Jewish Welfare Board, through their concert and lecture bureau, I think, I don't know whether I told you this, we were bringing a concert up and there was a colored man. We had the color line here. Did I tell you that story? This Bill Johnson, he was a great big color fella. He sang Yiddish and spoke Yiddish like he was born to it. Oh my God. Mr. Bluestone was in the hospital in the New York City. And when I found out, I didn't know what to do. One of the troop members, his sister lived in Wilmington. I don't remember what her name was. And I called her up. And I said, "You'll have to do something about it because I can't put him up." And I called the colored Y on Walnut Street. And they had dormitories. If I had more dormitories at my place, I certainly would see that he was put up. And I called up and I spoke to Mr. Anderson. I think that's who their first director was. Incidentally, when they built that building, he came to talk to Mr. Solid and I, and we met Mr. Solid's office, and it was on the strength of our programming, the two, the YM and YWHA in one building, that they built the Walnut Street Y, because they could see that it could work for men and women in one under one house. And so I called and I explained the situation to him. At first I called New York and I told them either they have to cancel it or please tell them I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Please tell them they must go back to New York after the concert's over and that I can't put them up. I didn't know where they were going to eat.
Was that because it was illegal?
Yeah, sure. Sure, we never went to school with black people or anything here. No. It was illegal. We were a southern state. So anyhow, they said that you're worried, it's not mine. I says, please don't let me insult anybody. Please don't have them come up. Or if they come up, tell them to go home. And they weren't going to do anything about it. And so that's why I called. And I says, I can't do anything without Mr. Bluestone. He's in the hospital in New York. And I'm trying not to bother him. And he was operated up there. So I said, well, will you please do this for me? And they said, no. So then I called up the fellow who was in the troop and spoke to the sister. She says, I'll give a party for them after the thing's over, she says, and he's welcome. She says, but my husband won't allow him to stay over either. And first of all, she says, I have only a small house, and I have children, and I can't put everybody up. The white people could all go to the Hotel DuPont, or we had another hotel called Darling here that was on a pretty good level. But I couldn't get him. And for lunch or supper, I called every place in town, and nobody would take them. And so, what's his name? Don Combe was our youth director then. He called up the Republican Club. And they said, sure, bring them all up. We'll serve them dinner. So the Republican Club served them all dinner. They didn't care whether it was white or black or what they were. And that's how we had them, fed them. For lunch, we had sandwiches and stuff there for them. And then when they all got up there, came into the center, I called them together and I told them. I said, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. There's nothing I could do. And the Y, at the colored Y, the Walnut Street Y, would not give me a room for them. They said they were completely filled up. And I says, now let me ask you something. I says, I know one time I was on a trip and I stopped at a motel and the place was filled up, but they had a room there where the man who had that room, he lived there all year round, he was a taxi driver, and they said he wouldn't be there that night. They would change all the bed linen and we could have that room for the night. I says, is there somebody that has a room that is going to be away for a couple of days over the weekend and put him up at that in there? He says, I'm sorry, I can't help you out. I says, well, if it was anybody in my faith, I says, I would call my whole board of directors and before until I found somebody to put up one of the men. And I says, can't you call any member of your board? I says, I want you to understand they're coming through the Jewish Welfare Board. This isn't anybody that's being picked up off the street. Now, everybody there are white except I have the one black man. And I don't know what to do. I says, you know what the situation is in Wilmington and the state of Delaware. So we thought for a while. He says, sorry, I can't help you. I says, you've been very kind and very helpful. Thank you. And I hung up. He didn't even help. He didn't care to help, I don't think. So whether he's trying to force an issue, I don't know. But he knew what the situation was in Wilmington anyhow. And so I just asked him all, after the thing was over, one of the fellow sisters came down. They had a party for them. And they had a wonderful time, and they all got in their cars, and they went back to New York. So that's how we solved that problem.
They all went back?
Everybody went back. The whole troop went back. I canceled all the reservations at the hotel where they were supposed to stay, and everybody left, and that was all right. So that Mr. Bluestone did have a degree in social work. That was his master's. And he says, when times were bad, it was depression, and the doctors weren't making anything. You get paid with potatoes and carrots and 50 cents or so. You got nothing. He says, I at least had work, which was true. And he loved the social workers field. He really did. He really loved it very much. But that was a whole new regime, and things were different then because the war had all petered out. And then we started with the rehabilitation business of the vocational guidance. And the strangest thing was the man that they sent in, B'nai B'rith, was going to sponsor it. The man that came in from New York to interview both Ben Coder and I'm just trying to think, well, it had to be Mr. Bluestone. It was somebody that I knew who originally lived in Wilmington. He was very glad to see me. As a matter of fact, he sent me a note while I was in the hospital. Shirley Hurwitz had met him at a conference, and he asked about me. She told him I was sick, and he sent me a note. I never did answer it. I really have to get to that someday. And so if I knew where he lived, I probably, she only gave me where he worked, JCRC in New York. So Sunday I could be a, or Sunday morning I could be a sport and call up. So anyway, he came, God bless you, and he interviewed all, you know, the top priority, like the executives and so forth. And the last night that he was in Wilmington, he came in. He says, "Now I want to talk to you. Talk to you as my friend. I want to know what's going on. I want to know everything that you did." And I talked to him, and I told him about the boys coming back and how footloose they were. They didn't know whether they wanted to go back to school again, whether they should go back for a degree in college or look for work. And everybody was just floundering around. And I says, "I think it's going to be a very important issue. And if anything could be done, we should do it." And he says, "You know, Molly, spent almost a week here. I just got more information out of you than I spent the whole week in Wilmington talking to all the top-level people. Because the boys came running in, you know, we'd sit and we'd discuss things. And they'd say, 'Gee, how can I go back to college? I've been away from it for so long.' And I said, 'Well, you have to try. That's all. It'll come back again.' Some were just out of high school. You know, they drafted them at the age of 18. They didn't even have a chance to go to college. Should they go to work or should they go to school? This was important. And so I said, it's going to be a very, very important issue, and you just have to get that vocational guidance in there. And they did. And I think the first worker we had was Sam Gluck. And then from there on, and we had it for quite some years until it petered out. I guess there was no money for it because the B'nai B'rith in Wilmington had to give a certain amount of money towards that program too. And I guess it was just hard to continue it. But they had it for many years, and I think they did a good job with it too. It was just too bad that they had to give up that program. We had some excellent men there, excellent men. Well, it's 5 minutes of four, dear. What else can we talk in 5 minutes?
Okay, Do you feel any difference in your feelings towards the Jewish community, like from when you were growing up and first starting to work at the Y and all?
Oh, yeah. I tell you, I don't think that they have the same feeling. Like, we had a feeling of belonging at the Y. If you didn't belong, you used to walk past the office. The minute you became a member, you walked right into the office and could come behind the counter and sit down and talk to me, talk to Solid, talk to Bluestone. Our doors were wide open. If they had any problems, they could always come in, or they just wanted to talk and pass the time of the day, they could always come into the office. It isn't that way anymore. It isn't. Because you don't have a feeling of belonging. You're there for a particular reason when you go up there now. You're there because you want to go to the gym or you want to get something dollar for dollar. It wasn't that way before. And believe me, I gave plenty of memberships away for nothing because I knew that the family couldn't afford it. And the board allowed me to do it. It's just like they had executive secretary. Well, you could call me executive secretary. But actually, at a board meeting when George Weiner was president, and it's in a minute someplace, they decided to give me a promotion. And I became the membership secretary then. And I said to Mr. Bluestone, he says, "The meeting yesterday, you just got a promotion, membership secretary." I said, "Am I getting an increase in salary?" He says, "No." I said, "Then you can keep the title." But from then on then, I really had a title as membership secretary. Because I think it was either the executive director or call me executive secretary. I wasn't actually a secretary to the director. I actually was secretary in the building. But it didn't make any difference. I took their shorthand and I did the letter typing and I worked with all of them because our staff was too small, that's all. We couldn't afford anything else. And so we did what we could ourselves. And the fact that we worked long hours is because it belonged to us. And the boys did things for nothing because it belonged to us. But they were volunteers down there because, and they didn't want to be paid for the work that they did with the clubs and everything, because this was part of our makeup. This is part of a belonging to an organization that was part of us. Our parents helped build this. And because they did, it was part of our life. So it was like home. If a boy had to came home, you know, from the camp, he'd get off at the railroad station. Before he even went home, he used to run into the YMHA to say hello, and then he'd go home. Because this was part of his home, too. This is part of his growing up. See, there is a big difference. Yeah. I walk up when I go into the place up there. I really shouldn't say this, but I don't have a feeling of belonging there. When the boys, they were killed, most of the boys, our boys, were killed in the Battle of the Bulge, and Dr. Barsky and Saul Cohen were going to put a plaque up there in honor of me, in memory of the boys, and they were going to pay for it, and I didn't know that until the whole Sigma Alpha Rho, one of the high school fraternities, were drafted into the service, and the boys came in to see me, and they said, "Ma, we want to put up a plaque. Only if you put every boy, I don't care if they belong to the Sigma Phi or what they belong to, every boy that was killed has to be on that plaque." They says, "That's the way it's going to be." I says, "Because then I'm going to call up somebody and tell them that we don't want their plaque, that you will buy the plaque." And so I called up Dr. Barsky. I says, "You're not going to give that plaque." So he says, "Why?" He says, "I want you to order it." And he says, "Molly, we were going to give it in your honor." I says, "I'm sorry." I says, "The boys are going to give it. They were in service, and they want to give it, and I think it's due them." And he says, "If that's the way you feel about it, okay." And that's what we did. And when I went under the, before I got, you know, with my operation, I went under the stage with Ralph Tomasz. And you know where I found that plaque? Under that crawlway. And I was horrified. What, are they ashamed of the boys being killed in service? They were fighting to make things better for us. At least that was the idea, you know. That was to be the war to end all wars. And so when I saw that, I mentioned it to a few people. And then Frankie Chaikin was the president. And I met his wife one day. And I says, "I think I was just horrified to see it there." I said, "Why don't they hang it up where people can see it? Why are we ashamed of this?" So when I was up there at Bitor's sister had a showing. She's an artist in Philadelphia. And I was invited, and I went up to the cocktail party. And Frankie says, "Come here, I want to show you something." And he took me, and he showed it to me. And it's on the side, on the wall, where you go into the office. So it's there, but I don't think it belongs there. I think it should be smack everybody right in the face when they walk in. That's where it belongs. Not where you have to look up. I says, "I'm glad you showed it to me." I says, "I'd never see it. First of all, that hallway is dark. And the second thing is, it's, you know, it's iron or whatever it is. How can you see it? Put a light over it at least. So when people glance up, they could see a little light hanging over it. You do it over a picture, put a light over that where people can see it." And it bothers me no end. So you're right when you say the feeling isn't the same. And when I see their program, I'm very delighted to see what they have there. And yet people do tell me, even on the street, and I'll say, "Gee, it sounds wonderful." And they say, "But the feeling's not the same there." It isn't. And I told Irv Kaufman when I first met him, I said, "You walked down there." I went to an annual meeting. And I said to him, "I had a feeling that you belonged here." And I pointed out, I says, "I don't know that man. But I says, I think he's our next director." And then when I met you, and when I went up to meet him up at the center and I sat and talked to him, I says, "Please open up your doors." And when I mean open the doors up, let everybody come in. Let them be able to come in and talk to you. And of course you have a lot of Christians there that we didn't have. Not that they didn't come in. They came in to join. But when I explained my program, and I said, I had a Catholic lady, and I think Johnny Russo called me. She had cancer, and she had two children. One was our age level for the day camp, and the other was a baby, and her sister was coming up to take care of the baby. So he says, "Molly, would you take her in day camp?" I says, "I'll talk it over with Mr. Bluestone," and I did. He says, "Only on condition that she knows that Friday night we have religious services for the children, Friday afternoon." And I explained, so I called her up, and I told her, she says, "I'm very grateful to you." She says, "Religion will not hurt anybody, and I don't care what faith it is." She says, "I am so grateful that you'll take my son to day camp." I says, "And he's welcome." And we did take that boy in. We had Sidney Clark's children, and we didn't care, as long as they didn't object to our religious program. They had no, and then we had a reunion. The same lady, the kid, the Catholic boy's mother, she came all dressed up with a hat on, our our girls ran in, you know, just dressed up in casual clothes. She came all dressed up, and she could never thank us enough. She eventually died for taking her child into that day camp. She says, "You really helped me out." So, you know, these are the things we did. But we didn't tell them they couldn't join, but I always explained our program. And they could make up their own mind. Well, now I guess we have to stop. I don't know if you have much left on this.